From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Neil Sedaka. In the late 50s, he was one of the songwriters churning out hits in an office building that became known as Pop's New Tin Pan Alley. To celebrate his 50th year in the music business, a new collection has been released featuring hits he wrote and recorded, including O Carol, Calendar Girl, Happy Birthday Sweet 16, Breaking Up Is Hard to Do, and Laughter in the Rain. It also includes demos of songs he wrote that were recorded by others like Stupid Cupid and Love Will Keep Us Together. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the new biography of writer Edith Wharton by Hermione Lee, who also wrote biographies of Virginia Woolf and Willa Cather. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the late 1950s, my guest was one of the songwriters churning out hits in a Manhattan office building that became known as Pop's New Tin Pan Alley. Neil Sedaka started out in the music industry 50 years ago. To celebrate that anniversary, he has a new CD called Neil Sedaka, The Definitive Collection, featuring the original recordings of hits he wrote and sang in the late 50s and early 60s, including O Carol, Stairway to Heaven, Calendar Girl, Happy Birthday Sweet 16, Breaking Up Is Hard to Do, and Next Door to an Angel. It also includes recordings he made in the 70s, like Laughter in the Rain, after Elton John signed Sedaka to John's own label, Rocket Records. And there's a few demos Sedaka recorded of songs he wrote that became hits for others, like Stupid Cupid and Love Will Keep Us Together. Sedaka's music was back on the charts 3 years ago, after he was a judge on American Idol, and Clay Aiken recorded Solitaire. Let's start with this 1961 Sedaka hit. Neil Sedaka, welcome to Fresh Air. Let me just ask you a question about the record we just heard. Now, you're double-tracked, your vocal is double-tracked on it. Why was that done so much in the late 50s and early 60s?
Well, I learned it from listening to some of the greats, Les Paul and Mary Ford, Patti Page, and I was one of the first in rock and roll in the late 50s and early 60s to do multiple voices. I'm a lover of harmony singing. I had a group in high school, in Lincoln High School back in Brooklyn, called the Tokens, who went on to their own illustrious career, The Lion Sleeps Tonight. I think it became a Neil Sedaka trademark. The early records were very, very happy and very positive, perhaps a little naive, but you could understand all the lyrics.
Now, when you were in your teens or just out of them, you had a knack for writing songs that would appeal to teenagers, maybe particularly to teenage girls, because the songs often had the message they wanted to hear, like they're growing up and becoming very desirable. Did you think about that consciously? Did you think of yourself as writing songs for teens?
Well, we were the teenagers of New York, coming from the Brill Building School of Songwriting. And yes, we were writing for the teenage market. The early lyrics or collaboration with Howard Greenfield, who was a marvelous lyricist and who could concise, it was almost the art of writing a 3-minute song. And we could tell a whole story in 3 minutes. Happy Birthday, Sweet 16, from the beginning to the end, is a little novelette.
Did you always start with a lyrical hook as well as a musical one?
I always wrote the melody first. Being a musician, I started as a student of the piano at the Juilliard School, so I was a very studied musician. I always started with the melody first. And I would prepare two or three melodies for Howie and play him that day. And whatever mood he might be in, he would choose one of those. And then it was a give and take. If the lyrics didn't fit, I would change a melody or a motif, and then he might change some things to accommodate me. It was a very close collaboration.
Now, were you in the Brill Building or the building near the Brill Building?
That's often 1619.
So that wasn't the Brill Building, it was the one next to it.
Yes, but we refer to it as the new Brill Building, the young writers, as opposed to the Irving Caesars in 1650, the old writers across the street.
So this is like the Rock and Roll Tin Pan Alley building as opposed to the Tin Pan Alley building.
Exactly.
So this is an office building where a lot of like young songwriters were working under contract, churning out songs. Who else was writing there when you were there?
I'm always asked, people are fascinated with the Brill Building. I brought Carole King, who I was dating in high school. Howie Greenfield and I were the first writers to be signed to Alden Music at the Brill Building. And then I brought Carole King and Jerry Goffin. The others were Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, Jeff Barry and Ellie Greenwich. Neil Diamond came for a time, Paul Simon. It was a very illustrious group, and it was excellent training. We came into an office, a cubicle. It was a tiny office from 10 in the morning till 5 in the afternoon, 5 days a week, and we wrote songs for a living. And it was, you know, one day you could come up with nothing, but the next day you were able to piece it together.
Were you all competitive with each other or friendly?
Well, you know, competition is good, and creativity, you bounce off other creative people. I think people are inspired by other musicians. So it was a good atmosphere. And at the end of the day, all of us would go into Al Nevin's office and play the songs, and they would say which artists are coming up for sessions, whether it be the Righteous Brothers or the Chiffons, or so many groups, and the best song won out.
Most of the songwriters there were writing for other singers. And you wrote songs that other singers recorded, but you wrote a lot of songs that you recorded yourself. Were you originally hired to write for other people?
I came in as a writer the first 6 months, and my two of my songs were recorded. Connie Francis did Stupid Cupid, and before that, Atlantic Records, Ahmet Erdogan and Jerry Wexler took my songs and recorded them with Clyde McFatter and Laverne Baker. But about 6 months to a year into the contract, I was 19, and I had a great desire to record my own songs. And I was brought into RCA Victor. Steve Scholes, who was the top A&R man, he had just brought Elvis Presley from Sun Records to RCA. And I auditioned for him with a song called The Diary, and he signed me to a 5-year contract. And, Terry, I was very fortunate. Between 1958 and 1963, to the shock of my family after studying at the Juilliard, I sold 40 million records in the 5 years. So yeah. I did.
Sure, your parents were happy about that in spite of their classical aspirations for you.
My mother, in fact, was not happy at the beginning. But, you know, I bought her Ming Stoll, so she was very, very, very happy after that.
When you were at the Brill Building, you wrote a song that was recorded by Gene Pitney. It's a great song. It Hurts to Be in Love. Now, I didn't know you wrote that.
I didn't.
You didn't? Wait,
no.
But it's demoed on here.
I know. It was written by Howard Greenfield and Helen Miller.
Oh.
And when I heard it, I was so excited, I wanted to record it. At the time, I was recording for RCA Victor, and I brought them in a finished demonstration record. And they said, well, it's good, but in your contract, it stipulates that you have to record in our studios. So I went in and tried to recreate it once again, and it failed. And I was very persistent and tried to persuade them to put out the demo, but they wouldn't. At that time, Gene Pitney came into the picture, a wonderful singer, and he took my voice off the demo and put his voice on. Subsequently, it was a monstrous hit, and you can still hear my demo when you hear his voice, but now it's the original demo on this definitive collection with my voice.
Did you participate in the orchestrations of this?
Yes, I played the piano and the hand claps and all of the background voices.
So is it your background voices and piano that we hear on the Gene Pitney version?
Exactly.
Really? So he just took the whole arrangement, took you out of the vocals and put his own on?
Yes, he took my voice off the track, and it was exactly the same track, yes.
Oh, that's really interesting. Well, let's hear it. This is the demo that Neil Sedaka recorded before Gene Pitney actually recorded It Hurts to Be in Love.
It hurts to be in love. So you cry a little bit.
Hurts to be in love.
You die a little bit.
Hurts to be in love.
Day and night, night and day. It hurts to be in love this way. How long can I exist? Wanting lips I've never kissed. She gives all her kisses to somebody else.
We just heard Neil Sedaka's demo of It Hurts to Be in Love, which is included on Neil Sedaka's new anthology, The Definitive Collection of Neil Sedaka. During the era that we're talking about, which is late 50s, early 60s, how often did you do American Bandstand?
Oh, five or six times, Terry. Dick Clark was a great friend and mentor. And he put me on his Beach Nut Saturday Night Show. He put me on the afternoon American Bandstand. And it was very exciting because I would run home from school to watch it. Little did I think that I would ever be on. It was a very, very exciting time.
What was it like lip-syncing on the show? How would you rehearse to lip-sync?
Well, you know, writing the songs and performing them for so many concerts, I had no trouble lip-syncing. So I take great pride in my old lip-syncing on those shows. And it was one of those things that you had to do. There were hops, teenage hops. You did a favor for the disc jockey by appearing at his sock hop, and in exchange he would play the record in the evening on his radio show. Alan Freed and Murray the K and Cousin Brucey. It was an exciting time.
Were there other favors you were expected to do for DJs to get the airplay?
But the hop was the big one, and maybe sign some autographs and appear on his radio show.
Payola, was that ever an issue when you were recording?
Not to my knowledge. I know that at the very beginning, RCA gave some refrigerators away and some televisions, but that was the extent of it. To launch a new artist, I think they did in those years give some gifts.
Like give a refrigerator to a DJ?
Perhaps.
What was it like the first time you heard one of your records on the radio?
The thrill of a lifetime. I'll never forget, my mother and I were driving in the car and down King's Highway in Brooklyn, New York, and there was a push-button AM radio in my car, and the diary had just come out, and I pushed three buttons, three different stations, and I was on three stations at the same time. Well, that was quite heady stuff for a teenager. It was a dream come true.
My guest is Neil Sedaka. His new CD is called The Definitive Collection. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is songwriter and singer Neil Sedaka. His new CD is a career retrospective of hit songs that he wrote. Now, I want to play another song that's included on your new collection, and this is Stairway to Heaven. And this is an example of, like, you know, an early rock and roll pop hit that had a pretty elaborate orchestration. I mean, am I hearing a bass saxophone on here?
No, it was a baritone sax.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And it became a trademark. I called it the sandwich song because it started with a piece of bread, climb up, way up high. And then the meat of the song was the actual lyric, well, oh, well, oh, well, a heavenly angel. And it ended again with a piece of bread, climb up, way up high. And it became a Neil Sedaka trademark, the sandwich song, I call it.
Well, another Neil Sedaka trademark is the Wella Wellas or the Come Doobie Doobies.
Yes, the Onomatopoeia. I was fascinated with the syllables sung to music, and that became sort of a trademark.
How did it become a trademark, and how did you figure out what syllables to use, whether it should be Wella Wella or Doobie Doobie?
Well, it started early in the career. And it was kind of someone singing along. Perhaps they were just getting into the song and they didn't get into the lyric yet. So they were going down, doobie doo, down, down, before they began the actual song. And it was, how did I choose the syllables? The most important thing in songwriting was the marriage of words and music. And the syllables had to fit the particular melody, and I was very keen on that marriage of lyrics or syllables set to music. I think the great writers, the Jerome Kearns, the Frank Lesses, the Irving Berlins, had that marriage of words and music that was the magic.
Okay, so here's Neil Sedaka singing his song, Stairway to Heaven, and this is one of the songs included on his new collection, the definitive collection of Neil Sedaka.
Climb up, way up high. Climb up, way up high. Climb up, way up high. Wella, 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 heavenly angel, I want you for my
That's Neil Sedaka from his new CD, The Definitive Collection of Neil Sedaka. Now, you know, we were talking before we heard that about how one of your trademarks is the, you know, the scat-like syllable things, Wella Wella, mm-hmm. or in the case of the next song we're going to hear, Dom Doobie Doobie, in Breaking Up is Hard to Do. What was the first song you did that on?
I think it was O'Carroll. I did double voice. But Breaking Up is an interesting song because I think I'm the only artist who has recorded his song twice. I did it first as a rock and roll song in 1962, and then I re-recorded Breaking Up is Hard to Do 15 years later as a slow gin mill song. And I don't think anybody else has done the same song in two different tempos. And by the way, both of them were huge successes.
Yeah, well, we're going to hear them back to back. But before we do, what made you decide to do a slower and more adult version of the song in 1975?
Good question. Lenny Welch a great singer who had a hit called Since I Fell for You, mm-hmm. was a friend, and asked if I had any follow-up to Since I Fell for You. And I was fooling around at the piano one day and discovered that Breaking Up Is Hard to Do worked as a slow song, and I presented it to him. He loved it and recorded it as a ballad, and it was an R&B hit. And then I would do it as an encore in my concerts. And the audience reaction was so good that I decided to re-record it as a ballad.
And you made some changes on it. It's not just that the tempo's slower. The chords are really different.
Well, of course, it's a more sophisticated. And when you have a ballad hit, it's a career move. It's a much better career vehicle. And when you're doing it as a jazz piece, you automatically change some of the chords to make them sound like a standard, like you're listening to a Dinah Washington record.
Okay, so let's hear Neil Sedaka's two versions of his song Breaking Up Is Hard to Do, the first from 1962, the second from 1975. Both versions are featured on his new CD, The Definitive Collection of Neil Sedaka.
Do 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 down do be do down down. Comma comma down do be do down down. Comma comma down do be do down down. Breaking up is hard to do. Don't take your love away from me. Don't you leave my heart in misery. If you go, then I'll be blue. 'Cause breaking up is hard to do. Breaking up is hard to
Neil Sedaka's new CD is called The Definitive Collection. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of The Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is a song by Neil Sedaka that was a big hit for The Captain and Tennille. Coming up, we talk more with Sedaka, and Maureen Corrigan reviews the new biography of writer Edith Wharton, which Maureen says is revisionary and convincing. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Neil Sedaka. He has a new CD of recordings that span his career called The Definitive Collection. It includes O Carol, Calendar Girl, Happy Birthday, Sweet 16, Laughter in the Rain, and his 1962 and 75 hit recordings of Breaking Up is Hard to Do. Now, of course, you know, in American Idol a few years ago, Ruben did a slow version of Breaking Up is Hard to Do, and Clay, of course, recorded Solitaire, and you were a judge, a guest judge. What kind of advice did they ask you? Did they give you before being a judge? Did they tell you to be nice or to take the gloves off and be tough?
Well, you know, I wanted to be tough, but my son said, "Dad, you know, there are 30 million people watching. Be careful of what you say." And, you know, I think that it's a very difficult, these kids are on in front of millions and millions of people. It's a very difficult thing. But I must tell you how I got on. Everyone was saying, "Oh, Neil, you must be a celebrity judge." I said, "Oh, there are so many people trying to get on." And my publishers called and said, "Perhaps if you called personally to the show, you have a better chance." And I picked up the telephone, spoke to a Susan Slema on the staff. I said, "Hi, this is Neil Sedaka. I watch the show. I'd love to be on as a celebrity judge." And she said, "Are you kidding? Who is this?" I said, "No, it's Neil Sedaka." She said, "Sit there. We're having a meeting." She called me back in an hour and said, "You'll be on in 2 weeks, and the five finalists will be singing all Neil Sedaka songs." I was over the moon.
What impact did it have on your career?
The catalog went through the roof. All of the old records started to sell. Amazon.com was ringing off the walls. And Solitaire by Clay was one of the biggest, I think the second biggest seller of that year.
Wow. Now, we were talking about how you grew up playing classical music and how your mother early on would have preferred that you play classical music. In those early days, were you torn in two directions, pop versus classical?
No, I was a very serious piano student. I started playing at age 8. At 9, I entered the prep school of the Juilliard when it was on 125th Street and Claremont Avenue. I studied with the great Edgar Roberts, and when I was 13, I discovered that I could write songs. I wasn't very popular in school. I wasn't a jock and wasn't one of the popular kids playing Chopin and Bach. So I was fascinated by the reaction I got. I was invited to all of the teenage parties, and that was a very big deal in those days, if you can play your own songs or hits of the day. So it was a twofold study of songwriting and going to Juilliard every Saturday, and then I went to the college, Juilliard College, studied with Adele Marcus. And when I was 19, I had to make a decision which direction to go. And, you know, the money is, being from a very poor family, my father was a taxi driver in Brooklyn for 30 years and worked very hard. And I think every teenager wanted to be a rock and roll star, that, you know, that would be very exciting to any kid of that age. So I did pursue it, but I never dropped the classical music because I still basically love it, and those are my roots.
In an autobiography that you wrote a few years ago, you write about a song, "Mr. Moon," that you wrote when you were in high school and that you performed in high school, but the principal didn't like the song. You describe it as having been a little risque for school. I was dying to hear how it went.
Well, I was a freshman at Lincoln High School, and as I said, not one of the popular kids. And I had started writing rock and roll. It was the beginning of rock and roll. And I wrote a song called "Mr. Moon" and sang it at one of the Ballyhoo shows in the auditorium. And there was to be two performances. The first performance, the kids started to jump and dance and bump and grind, and it was a sensation, except when Abraham Lass, the principal, called me into his office and said, "You know, Neil, we can't have that kind of behavior. We'd like you to do something else, another kind of song for the second performance." And there was a petition signed by the students that they wanted Neil to do Mr. Moon again. And we won, and I did it again. It was not a dirty song in any way, but it was kind of a bump and grind, chick, 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 you know, that old rock and roll tempo, which was very new at the time.
Could you do a few bars of it?
Oh, my goodness, I was 16. Mr. Moon, guide your love back to me. Ha, 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 ha. Sounds very, very fragile now. Very timid.
So what was it like for you having been an unpopular kid to then have a song that the kids really responded to? Did it change your standing in the school?
Oh, I was able to go into the sweet shop across the street from Lincoln High School. The sweet shop was divided into two parts. The first part were the kids that wore the button-down shirts, and the second half of the sweet shop had the black leather kids with the DA haircuts. And I was allowed to go into the back room with the jukebox and the leathers and the DA haircuts. They said, "Oh, let Mr. Moon go in." So you can imagine.
Are these kids who had beaten you up in earlier times?
They weren't too kind to me at the beginning.
Yeah, you know, you write in that memoir, you write, "By first grade, I was known as the school sissy. I practiced walking and gesturing in a masculine fashion in front of the mirror." So it made me think you were probably picked on a lot.
Yes, that was one of the reasons that I wanted to be recognized. I wanted to please people. I think in many instances, artists who begin as are neglected and are made fun of, I think that they pursue these careers to be noticed, to be accepted, and to be revered. So I showed those football players.
Yeah. Well, did it make you self-conscious when you started performing about whether you should look more macho as a performer?
I studied in front of a mirror. I had a sister, Ronnie, who I adored, and she was my hero. She was 18 months older, beautiful, popular, and, I had to stand in front of a mirror, I'll be totally honest with you, and learn how to move in a more macho way, how to carry my books, how to... It was a metamorphosis.
You know, I think in that era, every teenager was standing in front of a mirror, and some people were learning to dance in front of a mirror. Some people were pretending they were singing into a microphone in front of a mirror, and other people were just trying to figure out how to fix their hair or look better. But don't you think, like, every boy and girl was standing in front of a mirror then?
Yes, but I must correct you. I didn't use the word sissy. I used the word effeminine, because I was raised by six women. We were, believe it or not, 11 people in a two-bedroom apartment in Brighton Beach. My mother, my sister, my five aunts, and my grandmother. So these are the people who I emulated. So it was a marvelous upbringing because I was spoiled by all these women.
My guest is Neil Sedaka. His new CD, The Definitive Collection, includes this 1960 hit, Calendar Girl.
I love my calendar girl. Yeah, sweet calendar girl. I love my calendar girl. Each and every day of the year. January, you start the year off fine. February, you're my little Valentine. March, I'm gonna march you down the aisle. April, you're the Easter bunny when you smile. In a world, I love my little
Neil Sedaka will be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is songwriter and singer Neil Sedaka. His new CD is a career retrospective of hit songs that he wrote. Now, a few years ago, you recorded an album of Yiddish songs called Brighton Beach Memories. You grew up in Brighton Beach.
Yes.
Were these songs that you grew up hearing?
Yes. My mother played the Barry Sisters records. These were the great old standards. V'achin z'lechkein, Shein v'di levuna, my Yiddish mama. I heard them at bar mitzvahs and weddings and family picnics. And I decided at this stage of my career that I wanted to do things for my own heart, for my own spirit, not particularly looking for commerciality. And I got some wonderful reaction. I did an all-Yiddish concert at Carnegie Hall a couple of years ago for the Folks Bean Jewish Theater in New York. And wound up to be a very exciting album. I performed with a few klezmer groups in California and Chicago, the Klezmatics. And it was my roots, and I'm very proud of where I came from. I think, you know, you have to remember where you came from, and this was very special.
I want to play a track from the album. Let me ask you to choose one of your favorites.
I'd love to hear Yiddish Mama. I do it half in English and half in Yiddish. And it reminds me of my mother, who passed away last year, Eleanor Sedaka, who lived to 89. She lived a great life. But I think it was originally done by Sophie Tucker years ago, and it's a very moving, very emotional song.
Well, let's hear Neil Sedaka's recording of My Yiddish Mama from his album Brighton Beach Memories.
A Yiddish Mama Es gibt nicht besser in der Welt. A Yiddish Mama, oi weh wie bitter, wenn sie fällt. Wie schön und lichtig is in Heus, wenn die Mamas du. Wie treurig finster wird, wenn Gott nehmt ihr auf eulem Habu in Wasser und Feier wollt sie gelaufen vor ihr Kind.
This is Neil Sedaka from his album Brighton Beach Memories that came out a few years ago. Now he has a new collection that's called the Definitive Collection of Neil Sedaka. Now, earlier we heard two different versions of your song Breaking Up Is Hard to Do, one from the early 60s, one from the mid-70s. When did your string of hits in the 60s end? People always say that for the American pop songwriters and singers, their careers were really interrupted or ended by the British invasion. Is that too simplistic, or do you think that's an accurate description?
That's an accurate description, Terry. There was also a natural progression of 5 years of hits. The Everly Brothers, Connie Francis, Fats Domino, Brenda Lee. We all didn't have more than 5 years. But as you said, the British invasion, the great Beatles and Rolling Stones came. I wanted to write that style, and I did write that style, but my public wouldn't accept it, and the record company wouldn't accept it. So for 11 years, I took a back seat, took stock of myself, raised a family, had my two children, and wrote for a publishing firm, and had some great artists record my songs, Andy Williams, Johnny Mathis, Peggy Lee, Shirley Bassey. But you know, once you get a taste of being in front of the public, you never get over that. And it was 11 years later, in around 1974, 75, actually, that I lived in England. I moved my wife and children to England because in England they respected the original rock and rollers in America. And it was there that I met Elton John, who was starting a record company, Rocket Records, in America. And he was a big fan of my early records. And he knew that I was recording with a group called the 10cc's in Stockport, England. Marvelous group at the time. And I made two albums with them, and both of them were successes in the UK. And Elton said, you know, I think I could launch you again in America. And I said, well, that would be remarkable, you know, because I was known as the ghost from the past. Mm-hmm, people would come up to me in New York and ask, didn't you used to be Neil Sedaka? But Elton had me record in Los Angeles and incorporated some of the songs from the UK sessions and some of the songs from the LA sessions. And I had an album called Sedaka's Back, which was a remarkable comeback for me. And I always thank Elton for that.
Was Laughter in the Rain on that?
Yes.
Yeah, and that was a really big hit for you.
Well, after 11 years, to have a number one record was a remarkable comeback. And Love Will Keep Us Together was on, and The Immigrant, and That's When the Music Takes Me. I was very proud of the collection.
So how much are you still writing songs now?
I write once or twice a year. I wrote some new songs that I'm working on for a children's album. I actually rewrote, since I have three new grandchildren, my son and his wife got after me and said, you know, you're Papa Neil now, you have to write some children's songs. So I came up with the idea of changing the lyrics to some of my original hits. So I did Waking Up Is Hard to Do. I did Where the Toys Are. Don't Trip Over Your Toys, Put Them Away Neatly. And so perhaps I'll be Papa Neil on television. Who knows?
I'm trying to think of a really torchy version of Where the Toys Are. Well, it's really been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Same here, Terry. And it's a wonderful program. Congratulations. Continued success.
Neil Sedaka's new CD is called The Definitive Collection. Coming up, Maureen Carrigan reviews a new biography of Edith Wharton, the author of such classics as The House of Mirth and The Age of Innocence. This is Fresh Air. Distinguished biographer Hermione Lee is known for her lives of Virginia Woolf and Willa Cather, among other subjects. Now Lee's long-awaited biography of Edith Wharton has just been published, and book critic Maureen Carrigan has just resurfaced after a long, long read.
Edith Wharton's signature subject as a writer was paralysis. Over and over again, Wharton imagines characters so hemmed in by social expectation and their own personal constraints that at the crucial moment, they can't act. Lily Barton, Lawrence Selden, the main characters in Wharton's 1905 breakthrough masterpiece, The House of Mirth, are so frozen into their social roles, they can only declare their love for each other posthumously. Newland Archer, in The Age of Innocence, stares mutely at the home of the woman he loves, missing his final chance to connect with her. And Ethan Frome, in the gothic short story that bears his name, summons up just enough strength to try to break out of his grim marriage, only to find that his escape catapults him into a live burial. The commonsensical take on Wharton is that she wrote so vividly about paralysis because she experienced it firsthand. After all, Wharton debuted into the society of Gilded Age New York at a time when well-born women were expected to be passive virgin sacrifices on the altar of marriage. Even in her midlife transformation into a celebrated author, Wharton has been diminished, usually playing second banana to her great friend and mentor, Henry James. Hermione Lee, Wharton's latest biographer, will have none of this nonsense. Throughout her impressive, exhaustive, and yes, sometimes exhausting new biography called briskly Edith Wharton, Lee gives us a Wharton who always rose splendidly to the occasion, whether that meant dealing shrewdly with publishers or arranging a quiet divorce from her raving husband Teddy Wharton or touring battlefields and founding charities in France during World War I. Lee's Edith Wharton is the kind of vigorous heroine that Wharton herself never created. What's especially impressive about Lee's biography, and I don't mean this snidely, is that she fashions this revisionary and convincing reading of Wharton as dynamo, despite the fact that a lot of first-hand evidence is missing. Wharton destroyed much of her correspondence, as did Henry James, and so Lee's biography is dotted with rueful sentences like this one. Much of what Wharton felt is hidden from us. Fortunately, one person who squirreled away Wharton's letters was the great love of her life, Morton Fullerton. Fullerton was the 42-year-old journalist whom Wharton fell passionately in love with in Paris when she was 45 and still shackled to Teddy. Fullerton was a spendthrift, divorced bisexual who, when he began carrying on with Wharton, was involved with several lovers, one of whom was his own adoptive sister. Yet Wharton recalled their first meeting this way: "The moment my eye fell on him, I was content." Fullerton must have been magnetic, but one of the limitations of biography as opposed to fiction is that Lee can't dramatize Fullerton's charms, and he just comes off as a snake, slithering out of Wharton's life with the hackneyed line, "You'll write better for this experience of loving." There are other failings in Lee's comprehensive life of Wharton, most of them imperfections arising from overabundance. Wharton lived from 1862 to 1937, and much of her life was very social, so that Lee's account sometimes reads for pages like an appointment diary. Wharton wrote a lot of sensationalist magazine fiction, and Lee wades through too much of it. She also devotes too much space to Wharton's writing on house decoration and gardening. Even HGTV enthusiasts will find themselves benumbed by all these details about doorknobs and geraniums. A larger, unavoidable problem is that Wharton herself frequently comes off as unlikable, especially by the standards of our post-Imus age. She was a society snoot, a sexist, a racist, an anti-Semite, and a stodgy foe of the younger generation of modernist writers like Fitzgerald, Woolf, and Joyce. And yet there is, against the odds, the achievement of that writing life and those books, the greatest of which, Lee argues, is the underrated 1913 novel, The Custom of the Country, in which Undine Sprague figures as the carnivorous, anti-heroic inverse of the paralyzed characters Wharton creates elsewhere. Lee is such a superb and thrilling reader of the Wharton canon that she's got me vowing to reread Wharton again, to savor, as Lee astutely puts it, her style of hard, penetrating, analytic realism about a society that Wharton said was wholly absorbed in barricading itself against the unpleasant. Wharton may have been unlucky in love, but she has been lucky in securing the informed and infectious reverence of her latest biographer.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed a new biography of Edith Wharton by Hermione Lee. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our program was directed today by Jonathan Menjivar and Roberta Shurrock. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from TIAA CREF, helping those who serve others plan for and live in retirement. Online at TIAACREF.org. From 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting The History Boys, starring the original Broadway cast, on DVD tomorrow. And from Bonterra Vineyards, Mendocino, California, fine wines made with organically grown grapes and respect for the earth. Bonterra promotes responsible drinking. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, forensic veterinarian Dr. Melinda Merck talks about investigating crimes against cats and dogs. And animal behaviorist Nicholas Dodman offers some advice on how to raise a happy and well-behaved puppy. Join us for the next Fresh Air.